Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Ben Linden, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for Europe and Central Asia, who assesses the current state of the Ukraine war, human rights abuses, and after 4 years of brutal conflict, prospects for a lasting peace. Journalist and author Andrea Pitzer, who examines the Trump regime's mass incarceration of immigrants, haunting similarities to 1930s German concentration camps, and local communities rising up in opposition to these warehouse prisons. And Amanda Hollowell of the group Color for Change, who discusses Donald Trump's personal racism and his administration's aggressive attempt to reverse the civil rights movement's many victories to advance racial justice. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
50 years of nuclear arms control ended in early February as President Donald Trump allowed the New START treaty with Russia to expire. The expiring treaty was negotiated in 2010 by then U.S. President Barack Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, which capped the number of both nations' nuclear warheads and implemented advanced systems for verification and transparency. Russian President Vladimir Putin had offered to extend the treaty for a year on an informal basis, but Trump ignored his offer. Instead, Trump insists that any nuclear arms treaty must include China. But Beijing isn't interested, and negotiations to achieve an agreement could take up to a decade. Arms control experts warn that the expiration of the New START treaty could trigger a new costly and dangerous nuclear arms race. That's more likely now with the U.S., Russia, and China all developing a new generation of more advanced and harder-to-detect nuclear weapons systems that include hypersonic missiles, undersea nuclear weapons, and space-based weapons. The Trump regime announced on February 12th that it will be ending its deadly Operation Metro Surge in Minnesota's Twin Cities, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. The 9-week siege by masked ICE agents that arrested and brutalized thousands of undocumented and U.S. citizens alike also shot and killed Minneapolis residents Renee Good and Alex Preddy. After 3,000 federal agents swarmed the city, raiding bus stops, grocery stores, and churches, untold numbers of people across the region have been placed under de facto house arrest. Undocumented immigrants and other U.S. residents, regardless of their legal immigration status, feared they could be apprehended by agents due to the color of their skin or their accents, and have been afraid to leave their homes. Public schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul offered families the option of online classes. Neighbors have been delivering groceries to those who don't dare leave their house, and healthcare providers arranged home visits. Although the nonviolent protests against ICE in the streets of Minneapolis received the most attention, it was grassroots networks of activists who quietly and courageously went above and beyond their civic duty to resist ICE and protect their neighbors. U.S. states that were once leaders in childhood vaccination rates before the COVID pandemic are now among those losing ground as growing numbers of parents request exemptions linked to conspiracy theories and disinformation spread in part by Donald Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. According to a Stateline News analysis of federal data, increased parental and religious exemptions in Mississippi and West Virginia are likely to push both states from their previous top national vaccination rates. Other states like Florida, Idaho, Louisiana, and Montana are also making it easier to opt out of school children's vaccinations. At least 33 states fell below herd immunity rates in the 2024-25 school year, compared with 28 states in the year before the pandemic. Herd immunity refers to the percentage of people who must be vaccinated or be otherwise immune from an infectious disease in order to limit its spread. To prevent increased cases of measles, a highly contagious disease now on the rise across the U.S., states need to maintain at least 95% vaccination rates to protect those who can't get vaccinated, such as infants too young to receive certain vaccines, and individuals with underlying health conditions or immune deficiency. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
February 24th marks the fourth anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine that was preceded by its takeover of the Ukrainian territory of Crimea in 2014, as well as some parts of the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine that borders Russia, where fighting is now ongoing. Over the past 4 years, Russia has been attacking all of Ukraine, including the capital, Kyiv. In response, Ukraine has been carrying out effective drone warfare inside Russia's borders. The dead and wounded on both sides make up by far the highest casualties in any conflict in Europe since World War II. A recent Center for Strategic and International Studies report estimated that Russia has suffered 1.2 million battle casualties, including 325,000 soldiers killed, and 500,000 to 600,000 Ukrainian casualties, including 100,000 to 140,000 of its forces killed. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ben Linden, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for Europe and Central Asia, who assesses the current state of the war and prospects for a lasting peace.
You know, this is a war of aggression with one aggressor, and its name is Russia. Its name is Vladimir Putin. Ukraine is fighting a defensive war, and of course, Amnesty and human rights organizations will continue to call out human rights violations as we see them on any side, in any belligerent, in any conflict. But it's really critical to bear in mind that there really is one aggressor here and one country with an ongoing record, a pattern of violating international humanitarian law in the course of that conflict. So that's, I would say, the general situation. You know, we do see some progress, some reported progress on the diplomatic front. You know, we have talks in Abu Dhabi ongoing. There may be meetings at the Munich Security Conference. But the important thing to bear in mind is it's totally disconnected from what is happening on the ground in terms of the civilian casualties, the human rights violations. You know, 2025, we've seen some real diplomatic efforts. But at the same time, it's been the deadliest year for civilians in Ukraine since the start of the war. So it's like this duality we need to kind of bear in mind around the conflict.
So, you know, back when this started, I had some sympathy for the Russian position that, you know, they were being encroached upon, that, you know, a lot of Eastern European countries were joining NATO. There were others that wanted to join, and they were butting right up against, you know, Russian territory. And there had, I guess I had read, presumably been some kind of agreement that that would not happen. Now, 4 years later, I see killing on both sides, but of course, Russia is still hammering away at Ukrainian territory. And also, a month into the war, both Putin and Zelensky, apparently, there was talk of some kind of a deal. And then my understanding is that, you know, the U.S. told Ukraine, don't do the deal, keep fighting. You know, were there points anywhere along the way where this unbelievable bloodletting could have been avoided or minimized?
It's an interesting question. I think what is clear, though, is that, you know, Russia has continued to just push forward in its aggressive approach, really targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure over the course of the entire war. The important thing also to bear in mind is that we don't want it to end in a way that is unsustainable. We want it to end permanently. And the administration has said the same thing. You know, Marco Rubio has said, we don't want to be back here in 2, 3 years, you know, fighting the same war because we'd left things unaddressed. I think from a human rights perspective, that means accountability for the crimes that have been committed, for the alleged crimes and for the potential crimes against international law, including the crime of aggression committed by Russia. If that accountability does not happen, it leaves grievances that can fester over time and then reignite the conflict. You know, so of course we could end up in a situation where we have a transactional approach to ending the war. You know, give a little territory, take little, you know, do a prisoner exchange. Some of those things can be good and they can be part of a larger process. But we need to think through what happens the next day and how are we addressing the harm, particularly towards civilians, but also towards, you know, prisoners of war who've been mistreated by Russia, making whole the civilians who have lost even just property, or not to mention, you know, members of their families or their communities, and really going through a process there.
Like, is there any player who could step up and maybe make a difference in negotiations, like they would actually result in something rather than just talking?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think it's incumbent on anyone with power, and that includes also people that have power, like people on the ground, regular people that have power, to emphasize the importance of having a inclusive approach to this process that emphasizes the dignity of the people on the ground, the civilians and the people of Ukraine who are suffering as a result of this war. So whether that's, you know, the Pope or, you know, China coming and bearing pressure on Putin, or, you know, the US administration or Congress, I think there's a role for everybody to play. And I also just want to emphasize, you know, it's not just about outsiders coming in and kind of bringing their pressure to bear. Ukrainians themselves are also standing up, you know, for their rights. We see this every day. It doesn't make headlines, but we see members of civil society, you know, hospitals running on, you know, without electricity or without heat so often, teachers that are standing up and, you know, sometimes under occupation, teaching Ukrainian curricula in secret, you know, just everyday people kind of trying to do their part. And that's really something. And frankly, not even, and this is incredible, not even just against Russia, but against their own government at times when it's been necessary. So even last year, we had Zelensky's government basically try to crack down on the anti-corruption office, which corruption, you know, a long-standing problem in Ukraine. But you've had civil society standing up against corruption and for more transparent government.
That was Ben Linden, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for Europe and Central Asia. For more analysis and commentary on Russia's 4-year-long war in Ukraine, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In late December, Donald Trump deployed thousands of heavily armed ICE agents to Minnesota, who later killed Renee Good and Alex Pretty, and over 9 weeks harassed, assaulted, and abducted thousands of immigrants and U.S. citizens alike. In the face of this unprovoked violence, the courageous people of Minneapolis rose up to both nonviolently protest this mass secret police force in their city while activating volunteer citizen networks to support and protect their neighbors. Although the Trump regime announced on February 12th that most ICE agents will withdraw from Minnesota, the president's foot soldiers in his mass deportation campaign continue to lay siege to communities of color across the U.S., with ICE agents ordered to fulfill a daily quota of detainee arrests. The White House is now in the midst of spending an estimated $38 billion on a plan to acquire warehouses across the country and retrofit them into new immigration detention centers with capacity for tens of thousands of detainees who are remanded there without charge or trial. Your reporter spoke with journalist Andrea Pitzer, author of the book One Long Night: A Global History of Concentration Camps, who examines the Trump regime's mass incarceration of immigrants, haunting similarities to 1930s Germany, and local communities opposing the siting of these detention camps in their cities and towns.
You know, you see maybe footage of really awful things happening in Minneapolis. You hear about U.S. citizens being shot. You hear about masked law enforcement, kidnapping people, essentially moving them from facility to facility so their lawyers can't find them. Those all feel and are, in fact, part of the inheritance of 20th century concentration camp systems. But I think it's still hard for people to think about the larger project of what's going on, not just these individual terrible stories, but what is the bigger picture. And so right now there are about 70,000 immigrants in detention in the U.S. right now. And this plan of acquiring these warehouses is a goal to add another 80,000 people to that total in pretty quick order. And what I want to say is that before the election, Donald Trump was talking about deporting as many as 20 million people, which is actually more than the number of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. right now. But to put that 20 million in context, historians of the Soviet Gulag, and the Soviet Gulag existed for more than two decades, historians argue whether it was 18 million or 20 million that altogether across more than 20 years went through that system. And so what President Trump himself is claiming as a number that they're aiming for is something on that scope in one-fifth the time. So when you combine those police state tactics, you combine this kind of inaccessible detention where they ignore court orders and you see a lot of harm already happening, and you look at that size, those numbers, we're talking about potential for some really grim future for Americans if we don't put a stop to it.
The detention camps, the concentration camps that Donald Trump is now setting up across America are not death camps like the Nazi era, and that's a huge differentiation. But there are major concerns today about the inhumane conditions that exist in these camps. People have died. I've read that 32 people died in these detention centers in 2025. That may be an underestimate. And we've had reports of minimal or no medical attention that's available to the thousands of people in these detention centers. There's inadequate access to edible food or potable water, which contributes to a lot of misery, which may be the point. What can you tell us about the conditions that we're aware of inside these detention centers today?
Well, I think that how you get to one of these detention centers, which I kind of went through before, is the thing that most tells us this is a concentration camp system. But certainly the conditions in them are already also reminiscent of camp systems from the past, in which I would say a majority of camp systems around the world in the 20th century, the majority of illness, the majority of deaths were from women and from children. And we're seeing, we have a lot of reports of children suffering right now. And we know that there are some 4,000 children at least in detention, and 1,000 of them are being held longer than the court mandatory limit of 20 days. So 1,000 of them have already exceeded that. ProPublica did a great story with actual letters from these children and what their lives are like. And we hear, yes, conditions of people lying in feces, not having adequate food, people going to the doctor sick and being told to drink more water. But it's in fact the fact that they don't have good water to begin with, they don't have clean water, is a huge part of what's making them sick. And again, this echoes history of camps going all the way back to 1900. There are camps very much like this, and these are often the complaints that we hear out of them.
Tell us about the hope you take from residents around the country who are resisting the siting of these detention or concentration camps in their own backyards.
Well, it's extraordinary. It's been a very organic and fast response, and I think as people have a chance to get more organized, we'll see more of it. There's an online site called the Salt Box Project, and they have a warehouse map, so you can actually go there and see if something is coming near where you live, and you can be thinking about what you might do. But we've already seen in Ashland, Virginia, locals took against it, and the Canadian company that was going to sell the warehouse to the government decided not to. There's a Dallas County warehouse that ICE was going to use as a mega detention center, and they announced that actual company that was going to sell it to ICE said that they will not sell it or lease it, and it was partly because of the local response. So reaching out to your local officials, making your displeasure known, finding out who owns that facility, and I am not saying physically threatened, but I am saying you can do economic threats for them. See what their businesses are. See where they have holdings. Try to hit them where that money would hurt, or appeal to their humanity in a public way that will disgrace them if they are willing to have this happen. I think people should absolutely be going out and saying, not in my backyard. But at the same time, it is literally some of these tiny communities. I think of Tremont, Pennsylvania, which is slated for a warehouse. The detainees will outnumber residents by like a 5-to-1 ratio. They simply do not even have the infrastructure to do it if they were willing to. And I'm glad that so many people aren't. You see them just doing all kinds of things, working with city councils to make it so that people who work in these facilities, who contribute as contractors, will not ever get municipal contracts, will not be able to work as individuals in law enforcement or in teaching or in healthcare, in the public. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can attack this, and people are coming up with such creative ways to do it.
That was journalist Andrea Pitzer, author of the book One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps. Find links to Pitzer's newsletter and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Donald Trump had a long history of racist comments and behavior long before he posted a vile video on social media depicting former President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama as apes. From a federal lawsuit brought against Trump for alleged racial discrimination at his New York City housing developments, to the twice impeached president buying newspaper ads calling for the execution of 5 black teenagers falsely accused of raping a white woman in Central Park in 1989, Trump has rarely hidden his racist views. After his return to the White House in 2025, one of Trump's first executive orders eliminated all federal diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and revoked President Lyndon Johnson's 1965 executive order prohibiting federal contractors from discriminating in employment based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Over the last year, Trump has fired, without cause, dozens of the most senior black and Latino government officials at the Pentagon and other agencies, removed references to America's history of slavery in the Jim Crow era from museums and national monuments, and returned Confederate names to U.S. military bases, restored Confederate statues, and purge the names of thousands of non-white figures in American history from federal websites. Trump's current mass deportation policy, targeting people of color, is labeled by some as an ethnic cleansing campaign. Your reporter spoke with Amanda Hollowell, chief of campaigns with the group Color of Change. Here she examines the Trump administration's aggressive attack on America's long struggle to achieve racial justice and a multiracial democracy.
We label that as a neo-segregationist agenda as well, as this, you know, the far right legal and these policy actors are driving these results on anti-discrimination values with almost no consequence, you know, trying to return us to a Jim Crow era, essentially. We've been organizing around these coordinated attacks on democracy and education and history, you know, since January 2025. The commentary I can make is when you see the folks that he's aligned himself with, and when we did our expose on Project 2025 and we released a whole website, this wasn't hidden. This was the agenda. And we knew that attack on history and the erasure of our contributions was hit number one. You know, these are the same folks who control our textbooks and what we're learning, the limited learning that we have around our history in schools. So for us, it was more so, how do we, one, shape this conversation for everyone to understand what is happening in this moment and to not name this as a one-off Trump just is a racist and, you know, these are the things that racist people do, but more so this is an agenda of how you roll back civil rights in the country, how you erase people's contribution in order to take us to an era of Jim Crow era where we are denying black folks economic freedom, historical freedom, and the pursuit to be whole U.S. citizens.
You know, Donald Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, advisor Stephen Miller, they all seem very focused on taking the country back 75 years, as you said, back to the Jim Crow era, to try to eliminate the hard-fought gains of the civil rights movement that thousands of Americans fought and died for. I know your group is certainly focused on fighting to protect those rights that were won. What's the stage of this fight right now? Because Donald Trump, unless something unexpected happens, is going to be in office 3 more years. And we've seen how destructive his administration has been to the civil rights movement's gains just in the first 12 months.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're still winning in the courts. I believe by the end of the 2025, we had over 300 some odd court cases, plus 100 plus, maybe 50% plus one had already been won on the side of the people, demolishing and slowing down this administration's hurt. I think the other challenge we have is that folks make big deals out of things that, you know, that might be too nuanced for folks to understand, or we get too irate and into our anger on social media, we'll just call it what it is, without actually digging deeper to see who are winning those fights. And on the state level, a lot of folks are winning the fights against this administration, especially around their civil rights. You know, we want an injunction. It's just not the sexy story that's going to lead the national headlines. But there are folks who are winning against this administration. And there are folks like the ACLUs, the Legal Defense Fund, the lawyers committees of the world who are, you know, burning the midnight oil to make sure that they are stopping this administration from their continuing cruelty of people, of the U.S. citizens. When you roll back civil rights, it's not just about Black people. It's about folks with disabilities. It's about folks in the margins. It's about women. And if we keep letting these people do this and not fight back and not get into the courts and not sue them, you know, we are going to hurt not just Black people, but to a whole nation of folks who are the other 77 million that are directly impacted by his policies and his cruelty.
That was Amanda Hollowell, chief of campaigns with the group Color of Change. Find more analysis and commentary on Donald Trump's racist rhetoric and discriminatory federal policies by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, KMXT in Kodiak, Alaska, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.